I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, a jailhouse snitch is a person in jail who testifies in court that they overheard a defendant on trial confess to the crime. That informant benefits from all that. They can sometimes have their sentence reduced or even be released from jail. One man perfected the jailhouse snitch scheme. His outlandish claims even put men on death row. A new book exposes the life of lies of Paul Skelnick. Catch the Devil, the True Story of Murder, Deception, and Injustice on the Gulf Coast. The book exposes this trick of the trade for prosecutors that wins convictions when evidence is light and repeatedly allowed a man back on the street to continue wrecking the lives of others. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source. But first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Jailhouse informants can provide prosecutors with powerful testimony, but they also have strong incentives to lie. Investigative journalist Pamela Colliff's new book, Catch the Devil, tells the story of Paul Skelnick, a career conman who repeatedly claimed that fellow prisoners had confessed to him. Prosecutors used his testimony in dozens of cases, sending several men to death row, while Skelnick received leniency for his own crimes. One of those men, James Daly, remains on Florida death row and maintains his innocence. Pamela Colliff joins us to discuss how Skelnick's weaponized the criminal justice system and why prosecutors continue to believe him. And Pamela Colliff, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a great book. I got to tell you right off the top. Gripping read, like a true tale, true crime tale, but there's so much more here. So is Catch the Devil, is it fundamentally a story about one extraordinary con man, or is this really a takedown of the criminal justice system that allows this kind of dishonesty to be useful in trials?
I think it's more of the latter. I will just quickly say thank you for the kind words about the book. I wrote it in such a way that I hope it's propulsive enough in our attention economy to keep anyone reading. I always think about people like me who have big jobs, kids, a lot going on, and how do you capture, you know, their attention? So that was the goal. I think it would be easy to read this book as simply a condemnation of Paul Skelnick himself. But what I try to convey is that he really was just a small-time con artist, a very colorful and interesting one, to be sure. But he could never have done the things that he went on to do. He could never have eventually wielded the power that he had without tremendous buy-in from prosecutors and investigators who found the stories that he produced for them to be extremely useful in their work, in both winning convictions and getting long sentences.
Our phone lines are open. We want to hear questions and comments from our listeners about this tool, and it's not a good tool that prosecutors can use, the jailhouse snitch. I've seen it used. It's been in these many, many big cases. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So you actually sat down, you met Paul Skelnick, and you felt him work his magic on you.
Yes, I actually begin the book talking about how he worked his own con on me. And I thought that was an important place to start the book, because I think it's easy when you're reading a book or watching a movie about a con artist to have this sort of sense of superiority, like, well, this would never happen to me. So what happened to me was in 2018, I'd gotten a tip about him, and I went to a federal prison outside of Dallas to sort of make my pitch to him that I wanted to write a story about him, and I wanted his cooperation. I wanted him to tell me how he did all this, how for 40 plus years, you know, both the colorful details like marrying 9 different women, some at the same time, he was a bigamist, and all sorts of crazy hijinks that he committed onto becoming this invaluable source who, in one Florida county alone, played a role in 37 felony cases, some of them capital cases. And so he was very receptive to that. And so even though he told me things during the course of our 1 hour that we were allotted together that I knew weren't true, one was that he was dying of cancer and he pulled out a bloody rag to prove this to me. Another was that he owned a 100-foot yacht and he had a very old folded Xerox of it. I knew those things weren't true. But when he said to me that, yes, it seemed like it was time to tell this story, it was toward the end of his life, that I was the right person to tell it, and so on, I believed him. And what he had done was sized me up. He understood that I was someone who had a lot of drive to get this story and wanted it more than anything, and he gave me what I wanted to hear. This was his gift. So I drove back to Austin. I was elated. I called my editor. I said, we've got this incredible story. And I spent months trying to schedule time to go back to see him, to writing letters to him full of brimming with questions from these court documents I was going through. And there was something that would always come up. You know, he was not feeling well enough to meet with me because, again, he was supposedly dying of cancer, or there was something wrong at the mailroom, which is something that happens in prisons, and he hadn't gotten my letter. Long story short, many months into this, at that point where you have sunken cost, right? Like I had put so much time into this, I realized this guy's never going to tell me anything. He would string me along with little things, but nothing substantive. And that was the impetus for this book. It was, I'm going to find out this story if he's not going to tell it to me. And it took many years, but I uncovered a lot.
What did you want him to tell you, really?
I think I wanted him to tell me the mechanics of this. Like he said in our interview, he said, you know, when I worked with prosecutors, we never lost a case. Now, he was in the county jail at the time that he was doing that work. And I thought that language was so interesting that he saw himself as part of the prosecution team. He had a very close relationship with a detective who was the lead detective in a number of these cases that Skelnick ended up figuring prominently in. And so I just wanted to know, like, how does that work? I had to go back to Texas. I eventually figured out that's where he got his start as a jailhouse informant.
He was a former Austin police officer?
Yes. So he was a former Austin police officer in the early 1970s. He lasted for about a year and a half before he got caught writing hot checks. And he was not charged. He was just quietly dismissed. And that was the last honest job he ever had. And from there, he went on to commit what started being petty crimes. I mean, $50 hot checks. And it escalated from there. Every time he would get caught, he would, and he got caught a lot. He was clumsy and sloppy. He often worked under his own name. He would end up at the county jail, and his get out of jail free card was telling prosecutors, sizing up who it was in the jail who was the most valuable to prosecutors, which as a former cop could do, and then saying that that person had confessed everything to him, testifying at their trial, and then often getting a reduced sentence or freedom in return. And so as this went on and on, he was really enabled because he grew bolder and bolder about what he could get away with. And he went on to commit some pretty terrible crimes.
We're going to talk about that when we come back from the break. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Pamela Colliff is with us. She is an award-winning magazine investigative reporter, Texas Monthly. New book, Catch the Devil, The True Story of Murder, Deception, and Injustice on the Texas Gulf, on the Gulf Coast. We'll be right back.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to helping Texas communities and emphasizing safety. More at texasmutual.com/texansgetit.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin. Davies with me online is Pamela Colliff. Her book is Catch the Devil, The True Story of Murder, Deception, and Injustice on the Gulf Coast. She examines the life of a, she calls him a small-time con artist, con man, but he was able to use his ability to understand the criminal justice system to maximize being a jailhouse informant, a snitch, and put other people behind bars, can get convictions for prosecutors who were willing to use his ability to come up with astounding confessions, which were basically lies, to get those convictions when evidence was light, Paul Skalnick. So I don't want Paul Skalnick to get off to become across as like a lovable rogue kind of a character. He would write some hot checks. He would marry nine women at a time. He did a lot of, but he did bad things. He destroyed lives, didn't he?
He did. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because something I thought about the whole time I read this story is we have sort of an American romance, if you will, with the con artist, right? I think of, about stories like Catch Me If You Can, where you're really kind of rooting for the con artist. And I definitely play with that in the book. And I think as heartbreaking as the end of the book is, there's some dark humor in this book about how Paul Skalnick pulled off the things he did. But where things get more serious is when he goes beyond things like fraud and theft. And not to minimize that, just to quickly add, he was very good at preying upon women, often divorcees, who were economically insecure, and promising them everything financially. You know, he would wear all sorts of jewelry and fancy clothes and would love bomb them with flowers and all sorts of things. And at the same time, he would be cleaning them out and, you know, ruining their credit, which left a terrible damage to their life in addition to the emotional devastation. But it's really in 1982 when he crosses paths with a 12-year-old girl named Karen Parker. And I spent a lot of time with Karen. Karen was a precocious 12-year-old and thought that Skalnick was kind of a fascinating, louche character, unlike anyone she had ever met before. He drove a fancy car and so on and so forth. And he preyed upon her infatuation with him, and he sexually assaulted her. When she eventually went to police to report this, this was a very inconvenient story for the prosecutor's office, right? He's their star witness in all these different cases. And what ends up happening, even though there were two teenagers who were eyewitnesses to part of the assault, something you rarely have in a case like this, they had a prosecutorial, a case they could prosecute. The charges were dismissed. He was not prosecuted. And so Karen went through her life feeling disbelieved, even by her own family. It wasn't until several years ago when I tracked her down, and it was a long process. I was going through documents in which her name was redacted, and I had to use context clues to figure out who she was. And then here I am, like, parachuting into her life, and I have no idea what her family knows or how she feels about this. But she agreed to speak with me. And to me, that's a heart of the book, is what was done to her. I'll just add one last thing about Karen's story. When Karen came forward, she, at 12 years old, was given a polygraph exam This was without her parents. This was with a male officer. And all the questions were very skeptical questions about her account. Meanwhile, Paul Skalnick, who was allowed to testify in all these felony cases, including capital cases, was never had to take a polygraph exam.
He also was a domestic abuser to the yes. women that he was involved with. He would beat them.
Yes. One of the strange things is this was true of some women and not others. He had a very complicated relationship to alcohol that I think may have come into play there. But the combination of the gaslighting, you know, he told one of his wives that he was in law school. She supported him for several years, and he had law books strewn all over the living room and was always dashing off to go to mock trial and all these things. And he was not in law school. To another woman, he said he was a Southwest airline executive, and he would leave at the beginning of the day to go to work and come home at the end of the day, but there was no job. So there was for some, physical abuse. For all of them, emotional abuse and gaslighting, the financial abuse. And then just, you know, what do you do when the person you're married to turns out to not be any of the things they told you?
How was he able to marry 9 women simultaneously?
I think this would be harder in the era of social media and cell phones, but he was so charming. And I saw this myself when I went to speak with him. He would disappear for periods of time. There was always a story. Maybe he had, you know, he used to talk about these offshore bank accounts he had and all this high finance he was doing. So he would go on business trips. And it was during that time that he would cultivate these other families. There weren't children, but you know what I mean? These other relationships.
And he also claimed that he was a Vietnam veteran, a Marine, that he was a POW of the North Viet Cong.
Yes. So this to me was such an incredible parallel between the two men in this book. So on the one hand, you have Jim Daly, the man on Florida's death row, who was horribly damaged. You know, he began as a kid with so much promise and such a wonderful community. And he ends up going to Vietnam in 1968 at the height of the Tet Offensive and sees some really terrible things. And in the book, I say that I think that experience broke something open in him that couldn't be put back together. And so he never talks about what he did in Vietnam. It's very private and painful to him, but he bears the scars. Meanwhile, Skalnick is a stolen valor guy. And he says that he was this war hero. He was a fighter pilot in Vietnam. He was shot down and taken captive, eventually escapes and was awarded 2 Purple Hearts. And he talks about this all the time and, you know, makes friends with other veterans and really plays upon that. And
he even got benefits from the VA?
He tried to. He told people he was getting cancer treatment when he was posing as a terminal cancer patient at the VA. Later, a U.S. Marshal looked into that and could find no record of any medical care that was given there.
So walk through, like, how does it work to be a jailhouse snitch? He could just invent out of whole cloth that he had a conversation with a defendant, someone who was on trial, and say, hey, this guy told me that he did it, and come up with very theatrical details, and that would be enough.
Yes, this was one of the things that was so incredible to me, was the lack of corroboration. So this works in a couple different ways. Something interesting that happened in Jim Daly's case was he had a co-defendant, Jack Piercy, who ended up getting a life sentence, not death. Prosecutors really wanted a death sentence. It was a horrible crime. And it was the tough on crime 1980s.
Right. And we should mention the name of the victim. Yes. Shelley Boggio, she was a young girl, and she was brutally murdered. It was a horrific crime.
Horrific crime, absolutely horrific crime, and her family understandably wanted justice. When Jack Piercy, the co-defendant in that case, got a life sentence instead of death, which is not what the state attorney's office in Pinellas County wanted, the lead detective in the case went into the Pinellas County jail. He starts pulling guys out of their prison cells, 15 in all, and these are all men who are living side by side with Jim Daly. And he says, "I want to know what you know about Jim Daly's case." Now, there are four of those men, I wasn't able to contact all of them, but four of them who remember that there were newspaper clippings spread out in the room that they were taken into and questioned about this murder. And those newspaper clippings held all the basic details of the crime. One said to me, it was very clear to me that I was being asked to manufacture an account here from Jim. None of them do. And I should say that the detective to this day denies that there were newspaper articles in the room. So the word is then out at the jail that this case needs a snitch. And it just so happens that Paul Skelnick is once again in trouble, lands back in the jail. Weeks before Jim Daly's trial, he's moved to the same area of the jail where Jim is located. And within 24 hours, he reports to the lead investigator in the case that Jim, a total stranger to him, has confessed this crime. And in great detail, he has a terrible story that he recounts to prosecutors that's indelible.
So that's also part of Skelnick's abilities. His ability to tell a story.
He was so good at weaving a story. And I think something I thought a lot about after, he sort of convinced me that he was going to tell me all these things he didn't tell me is I thought about a woman I spoke to who ended up being his ninth wife. And again, I think there are more. Nine was how many I was able to find. And she told me, she said, "Paul always weaves a little truth into his lies, enough truth that you can believe him." And I think that was true. What he would do in cases like Jim's and others is there were newspapers that would come through the jail. There wasn't a lot to do in the jail, but they could read the newspaper. And you'd be surprised at how much basic information about a crime is in an article like that. And sometimes I would take his testimony in the transcripts I had, and I would put it side by side with the media coverage, and I could see where he had gotten things.
Any evidence that Skalnick was coached by prosecutors?
I don't have evidence of that. Now, he, in 1988, when he gets frustrated with prosecutors that they're not letting him out of jail, because at that point he'd committed so many different crimes, he makes a sworn statement saying that prosecutors did all sorts of terrible things in some of these cases that included coaching his testimony. Now, when he did that, the state attorney's office made the incredible argument that everything he had said prior to that in these other cases was rock solid, but this claim was false. And I thought this was so fascinating, this moment when the tables are turned on the prosecutors themselves. Long story short, they end up giving in to his demands, and he gets a sweetheart deal for this crime he's serving in Florida, and then another one in Texas, and he's out very shortly afterward. And in exchange for that, or that's my assumption, I'll just say at the same time, Skelnick recants his story that he was coached.
We're taking a break here. We're going to continue our conversation with Pamela Caulliffe. Her book is Catch the Devil: The True Story of Murder, Deception, and Injustice on the Gulf Coast. You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We're going to find out more about about Paul Skalnick, the career small-time con man who was a jailhouse snitch. How did he benefit from these deals? And what happened when he was allowed to leave jail early or at all, didn't have to face the consequences of putting him back on the street to continue his crimes? Call in 833-877-8255. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Support for TPR comes from UT San Antonio, offering degree programs and research focused on workforce development, student success, and health innovation across Texas. UTSA.edu. UT San Antonio, the University of Ambition.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Catch the Devil, the true story of murder, deception, and injustice on the Gulf Coast. The author is Pamela Colliff. She's a national investigative reporter. She's well known for her writing about true crime in Texas. Joe Bryan is a story about blood splatter that you investigated, which I remember, incredible story that you did. So how often did Paul Skalnick pull this jailhouse snitch scheme?
So he did this upwards of 40 times. 37 that I was able to find in Pinellas County, Florida, and then with three different defendants in Harris County. And again, I mean, this is after so many years of research. I began this project in 2018. My hope is that when the book comes out, that there'll be missing pieces that are filled in by some people that may come forward. I think there's still a lot of tentacles to the story.
What kind of benefits did he receive for doing this job for prosecutors?
So he got all sorts of things in return, again, that we know of. I think the one I was the most intrigued by, well, the one that was the most horrifying, really, was he was released very shortly after Jim Daly was sent to death row. And I thought that was such a just stark example of how this can work. But there is evidence that he was taken outside of the jail at a time when he'd been particularly useful in the early 1980s. And he had been brought to his girlfriend's house by two detectives. And she served him lunch, was the way that he put to me what this meeting was. And said that he was not allowed to lay hands on her. But of course, when he told me that story, he winked at me as he told me that. So read into that what you may. But things were just so loose, both in Harris County, in Houston, and in Pinellas County in Florida in the 1980s, in a way that's hard to imagine today. But what's so important in this book is, when you have a case like Jim Daly's that was tried in the 80s, there's a legal scholar named Stephen Bright who calls these cases zombie cases because they have all the problems of a different era of policing and prosecuting, but they're still with us. Jim Daly is on Florida's death row today, and he's had an execution date that was stayed, but at any moment, anything could happen. So we still, even though some of these practices have gotten better, they're certainly still with us. What do we do about the hundreds, perhaps thousands of people who are serving life or death sentences based on this kind of testimony?
Yeah, so I do want to talk about the law, the Constitution, when it comes to this practice using jailhouse informants. It does smack of prosecutorial misconduct. Any response to that?
So I think what's difficult and why I want to be careful in what I say is I think it's plausible at the beginning of a process like this that perhaps someone could believe that this is something that's happening. And you can see where there are feedback loops. A detective in questioning someone who becomes a jailhouse informant can end up giving that person information without realizing it. I mean, sometimes things are fed to people for sure. But just the act of asking questions, a smart jailhouse informant can piece things together. And then when a prosecutor hears that information, it sounds credible. So there are all sorts of things at play, whether it's tunnel vision, whether it's the pressure that's on police and prosecutors to solve and prosecute these crimes. I think in the time in which Skalnik was doing dozens of these cases, it's obvious that people just were not asking questions that should have been asked. But then there's that element of plausible deniability. That by the time of Jim Daly's trial in 1987, Skalnik had been used in cases in Pinellas County since, I believe it was 1981. So a prosecutor can look back at all their predecessors and say, well, these people, some of whom taught me everything I know, used him and didn't see a problem.
But the fact that he would do it again and again and again, that he would miraculously find himself hearing confessions from people who were on trial and then be able to show up at trial and present this testimony that just happened to be the smoking gun that put people away. That's got to raise some suspicion that a reasonable person would have could figure out that there is something going on here. There's also, you know, this has been found to be unconstitutional for a prosecutor to knowingly, you know, solicit false testimony, or when they realize that testimony is false and then they allow it to go uncorrected, that's supposed to be grounds for a new trial.
That's correct. And I think there's a passage that I wrote in the book where I talk about how when Skalnik takes the stand at Jim's trial, everybody but the jurors sort of understand what jailhouse informants are and all the problems with them. I talk about how the judge was the judge who gave Skalnik his first deal back in the early 80s, how the prosecutor had used him before, how the defense attorney, you know, knew some of his misconduct. But jurors don't know that. And when a jailhouse informant is put on the stand, you have to think about the implicit credibility that a prosecutor gives that witness when they get on the stand. So just as an example, in a typical murder case, your very first state witness might be the responding police officer who came to the crime scene, someone you're most likely going to believe. Then there are more investigators, then maybe a paramedic. And someone like Paul Skalnik is then put in that array of witnesses. And to me, it gives this what I call the patina of credibility to his testimony. There's another thing that jurors aren't aware of, which is when a witness like this gets on the stand and a prosecutor says, "Have I promised you anything in exchange for your testimony?" Usually that witness can say, you know, "No, sir, no, you have not promised me anything." But that's because there's an implicit understanding. This is something that Alexander Natapov, a law professor at Harvard, has written about extensively. There's an implicit understanding by anyone in jail that if you are going to help police and prosecutors with their case, you're going to get something in return.
And that's what he did, at least in the Daly case.
That's exactly what he did. And what was interesting about visiting him at the end of his life was just his utter, you know,
Could you ask him to come clean about that?
I asked Skalnik, yes, very much so. And I said, I think at that point there were fewer than 30 days until the execution was going to happen. In Florida, the death warrant periods are very short when you have to do all this new investigation. And he just didn't care. It was interesting. There was one person I asked him about where I could see that he was affected by the fact that this man was still in prison. It was a man named Freddie Gaines, who I write about in the book. And when he was in his early 20s, he was in a bar brawl. And at the end of that bar, he got in a fight, you know, got out of control. At the end of the bar brawl, one person's alive, one person's dead. Freddie's alive. The victim has multiple stab wounds and is dead. And this was, again, a terrible crime, but nothing about it indicated that it was premeditated. I would argue if you're going to carry out a premeditated crime, you don't do it in front of 50 people at a bar. And the case had this sort of Rashomon aspect to it where nobody could remember who had the knife, who got it out, how that began. So Freddie was looking at maybe let's say 20 years for a case like that where you just there wasn't the premeditation. Skalnik gets on the stand and says that Freddie told him that he had elaborately planned this out and that Freddie had boasted about this to other men in the jail, that he was so proud that he had done this crime. And with that, prosecutors get a life sentence for Freddie. So he went in when he was, I want to say, 23 or 24 years old. He's still there now in his 60s. So even when people committed the crime, this type of testimony was deeply harmful.
And you said Skalnik had some form of remorse about that?
He did. When I brought up Freddie's name, Freddie's a very personable person, someone you would remember years later. He's funny and has a good sense of humor despite everything. He looked a little painful. Pained and wistful, and just said, "That's really a shame. He shouldn't still be in prison." And that was just one of the only moments where I didn't see an evidence of a conscience exactly, but there was something there.
We're going to take another break. When we come back, Randall will get you on the air. You can comment. Also, our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. What do you think about prosecutors being able to use jailhouse informants in order to get convictions or to get tougher sentencing? What do you think about that? You think the law needs to change, or should the law be enforced? Because already the law is there. We're going to continue our conversation with Pamela Koloff. Her book is Catch the Devil. We'll be right back.
A year ago, one of the deadliest floods in U.S. history tore through the Texas Hill Country. Since then, we've been following up with survivors.
Everything is gone.
And people who lost loved ones.
I find myself just shaking my head, saying, I can't believe I find myself here.
You can hear their stories on the podcast After the Flood from the Texas Newsroom and PBS's Frontline, out now.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Pamela Koloff is with us. Her book is Catch the Devil. Let's go to a caller, 833-877-8255. Randall, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Hey, Dave, this is a pretty interesting topic you have going on here today. Ms. Koloff, I don't know if this is something you cover in your book, but I've been sitting and listening to all of this and wondering, what's the legal history of this tactic or strategy? We've had jails and prisons and prisoners going, you know, well back to the 18th century, using prisoners to snitch on each other and so forth. How far back does this go? I mean, is this something that the colonists and the founding fathers brought over from England, or even farther back than that?
All right. Randall, thanks for the great question. Appreciate it. Pamela.
Thank you so much. That's a great question. And I wish I were more equipped to address it. I know that this practice goes back, yes, to England and is a very, very old practice. And it has been upheld in various legal rulings, particularly in the 1960s. I think what is so confusing to me, and this would be better to have a lawyer weigh in than me, is that going back all that way, we've had many ways of preventing hearsay from coming into the courtroom, you know, someone getting on the stand and saying, I heard this. There are many hearsay exceptions, and this is one of them. But there are very, to me, it's at odds with that type of legal concept that you can't repeat what someone else says as testimony, and especially when there's such powerful, powerful incentives.
When prosecutors put Skalnik on the stand, say like at the Jim Daly case, were they required to explain his criminal record? How did any of his background come up?
So it's really up to the defense attorney to delve into what that is. Now, in this current day and age, when in some counties, but not in many, court documents are digitized, it becomes a little bit easier. It's still very, very difficult, especially if someone has done this across different counties or across different states. But back then, it was really up to defense attorneys to unearth all this. And it's hard to overstate how difficult that is. I mean, you have underpaid, typically public defenders who are trying to track down all sorts of different things in a very compressed time frame, sometimes without the benefit of an investigator to help them. The thought that they're going to comb through years and years of court cases to figure out if this person took the stand elsewhere is very, very difficult. So really all I saw in the cases that I wrote about were cross-examinations that just fell very short in terms of what they were asking. And Skalnik would also lie on the stand about his own past as well. He would speak about having been a police officer rather than the unsavory things he had done.
In the notes of the prosecutor in the Jim Daly case, there was sexual assault was scratched out. What's all that about?
Yes. So when the case came sort of back into the courts in 2019, when Jim Daly was given a death warrant, and let me just explain because this is confusing. When you're sentenced to death, you don't immediately face execution. There are years, often decades, of appeals and post-conviction review that go on. And so when he came up for that, this brought to the fore all these different things, including old records that hadn't been in previous trial proceedings. And that included a page that one of the prosecutors at Jim's case appeared to have written while he was cross-examining Paul Skalnik. And it tracks with some of the things that he asked Skalnik about on the stand. One of the things that he crossed out says something to the effect of sexual assault. And so Jim's attorneys told the court that they thought what that meant was that prosecutors did know about the sexual abuse of this 12-year-old girl, Karen Parker, back in the day, and that it had been dismissed, but chose not to ask him about it. That was denied to me by the prosecutor in question.
So he said he didn't know.
He didn't know. And to be fair, he was a relatively new lawyer in that office. He was not in the office when that charge came about.
It seemed like Skalnik was kind of an Epstein character who's a pedophile and would use his connections and would play the system in order to continue to be a predator.
That's exactly right. So in the same way that he had some of the same proclivities with teenage girls, he also was masterful at working his way into the trust and the lives of some of these police and prosecutors. Incredibly, when he was released, I mean, he had been in jail so many times at this point. This was in the mid-80s. He started a private investigator firm, and his services were used by a former prosecutor from the state attorney's office who had him serve papers and do things like that. So, and he was very chummy with a lot of the police officers. He knew, as a former cop himself, how to ingratiate himself with those folks.
The state of Texas has passed laws trying to, I guess, I don't know, crack down is the word, but to look into this practice of jailhouse informants. They now require counties to keep a database of the use of this practice. There's no centralized statewide database, which wouldn't be hard for them to require, but these are not public information. It's not open to the public. You have to file a public information request to get this data. It's clumsy, hard to get to. It seems like Texas could do a better job of trying to prevent the weaponization of jailhouse informants.
Yes. On the one hand, Texas should be commended for trying to do anything on this. Most states are not. And I think a county registry is helpful. I don't think it addresses ultimately the question at hand. First of all, you're depending on people to report to the registry. You're depending on overworked defense attorneys to think to check the registry and file those papers that you need to do. But moreover, they're just, you know, I found that if a case had a jailhouse informant in it, it was a red flag. There's not a good case that has a jailhouse informant in it. I would challenge somebody to come back to me.
Yeah, talk about the record of cases being overturned that have used jailhouse informants.
Yeah, yeah. So in the National Registry of Exonerations, 25% of death row exonerations involved in some part or another jailhouse informant testimony, which I think speaks for itself about how poisonous this is. And I found as a reporter over the years, whenever I saw that a case had a jailhouse informant in it, it was a bad case. That's not to say that the defendant was necessarily innocent. That is not what I'm claiming. But something was wrong. They didn't have enough evidence. They were trying to get a greater punishment than maybe the evidence suggested. And so it, to me, was always a reason to dig deeper.
Your book is probably going to bring more people to coming out, reaching out to you with stories of Paul Skalnick. What would you do with that information? You already wrote the book.
I am so hungry for any and all information that people have about him. He grew up in League City, Texas. He got his start as a jailhouse informant in Houston. And
the Moody Park Three, we should mention that.
Yes, he briefly attended UT and was a police officer there. So I do think that people know more, and I would love to hear from them. I will keep writing about this. I can't stop. There's too much at stake here right now. Jim Daly currently faces the possibility of execution.
Yeah, he's 80 years old, sits on Florida's death row. We don't know what will happen there. They could just let him be in limbo. But it does seem like there's a lot of evidence that shows that Paul Skalnick's testimony was critical in his trial. And under the Constitution, that is should not be allowed.
Correct. And I think one of the things about Jim's case that's so maddening is you can see that these safeguards we're supposed to have for cases like this fail when you have state-sponsored testimony coming from a jailhouse informant. So Jim has exhausted all of his appeals and post-conviction work. And yes, I mean, it may be that the best outcome for him is not getting a date and just being on death row. But I think that's a sad commentary on what our criminal justice system is able to do.
And people, if you sit on a jury and they bring out a jailhouse informant, you should look at that with a jaundiced eye. Pamela Colliff, thank you so much. The book is Catch the Devil. a true story of murder, deception, and injustice on the Gulf Coast. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.